You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. For the last year and a half, Kennedy Vincent has been our connection. Our inaugural host and producer of Dialogue recently departed Illinois Public Media.
The Congolese population has grown in the area to over 6,000 residents. Many Congolese immigrants come to the U.S. on sponsorship programs for resettling refugees.
That was a segment about Champaign Urbana's Congolese community, which won a Crystal Mic Award from the Illinois News Broadcasters Association only months after Dialogue premiered. Whether she was reporting on blurreds, black nerds, Afrofuturism, black maternal health, or carnaval, Kennedy gave every show her all.
Carnival traditions have long been a vibrant expression of resilience, joy, and cultural identity. Rooted in the histories of African diasporic communities, these celebrations emerged as acts of defiance against colonial oppression and enslavement. Over time, they have evolved into...
From your Illinois soul and Illinois Public Media family, thank you, Kennedy Vincent, and best wishes for success in the future. You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Illinois Public Media News and Public Affairs Director. Since Donald Trump returned to the White House as president, millions of Americans have taken to the streets for No Kings protests. In mid-October, organizers estimate roughly 7 million people turned out to express their displeasure with Trump. In Illinois, there were gatherings from Chicago to Carbondale. Here's a taste of what it sounded like in Urbana.
Hey, hey!
So what was the point of No Kings? What do those millions of Americans want to see happen? And how do these protests fit into the larger context of American history? Recently, Brian Mackey, host of The 21st Show, talked with civil rights attorney Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Let's listen into their conversation.
She's a civil rights attorney who's litigated cases for the Southern Poverty Law Center and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She's also a professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And perhaps most relevant for our conversation today, this year she came out with a book. It's called A Protest History of the United States. Professor Gloria J. Brown Marshall, welcome to The 21st Show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, top line reaction to what we saw happening this weekend. What did you think?
I think it's a wonderful thing when the people have an opportunity to communicate with their government, especially when they believe the government is not listening and is on the wrong path. And so protest is patriotism. Protest is patriotic. And to me, protest is a way in which the people show their power.
Did you participate in any of the protests either this weekend or this year?
I have been protesting since the third grade. And so I'm not just an I'm not just an academic. I also have a great belief in protest as part of my constitutional right in this country. And I did protest in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was in the No Kings protest there. And I just believe that it's important for the country to express its concern about the path the government is on right now.
What do you think of this idea that you know, people on the right were promoting that this would be, you know, some sort of Antifa, you know, bomb throwing, setting buildings on fire, that kind of thing?
Protesters have always been maligned by the status quo and by oppressors. I like to give the example of dreptomania. Dreptomania was an 1851 term for a disease of the mind that enslaved people had when they ran away. When they protested slavery by running away and becoming fugitive slaves, when they protested bondage, they were called mentally ill and suffering from dreptomania. So that was 1851, and it's called pseudoscience now, but it was definitely called science then. It was always this point of maligning the Americans who were colonists, who signed the Declaration of Independence, which is a protest document. They were maligned by King George and those English. And so we've always maligned protesters. And then at some point, there's a turn when enough people protest in the street, when they figure out different ways to protest, whether or not it's selective buying or sending letters to elected officials or deciding that they're going to have sit-ins or teach-ins. But sooner or later, over time, when we start to disrupt the economy that's being used against us, our tax money is being used against us by this government, then the maligning will get worse, but then the change has to come after that.
You know, there's been so much like kind of small scale targeted economic action, right? Some people won't shop at Target because they don't support Pride as much as they used to. And other people, you know, won't eat at Chick-fil-A because Chick-fil-A opposed same-sex marriage years ago. And I have a relative who doesn't like shopping at Hobby Lobby because that company opposed the Affordable Care Act's birth control provisions. You know, what would it take to actually do a mass widespread? I mean, is there precedent for that in American history? I think that's something we more commonly associate with other countries, right? Sort of general strikes.
Well, I've been a victim of and a participant in general strikes that have taken place in Europe, for example. My concern is what the caller or the email person or texter said, that what is the message? And we don't have the type of leadership that can come together with a clear message. And I think without that messaging, is it about constitutionality? Are we afraid that we're on the path of a monarchy, which I believe we are, because of capitulation of Johnson and others in Congress to the will of Donald Trump, and because they want to personally stay in positions of power and they don't care what they give up in their value system in order to have that power and that title. So how do we shake them out of that? And that takes some economic change. This is a capitalist country that's always been in conflict with its freedom and liberty roots. And that's what I talk about in my book, A Protest History of the United States, that the United States has the capitalist empire building side of the personality and culture of this country. And then we have the symbolized by the Statue of Liberty, the freedom loving parts of liberty of this country. They're always at odds. And so we're going to talk about liberty and justice for all community going forward, and not patriotism in this sense of only certain people with money should be at the leadership of this country, then we've got to get the messaging together. And I give props to the conservatives. They've been able to message, and they've been able to control media in a way that is very helpful to their side. We need to figure out how to get the word out, what the word is going to be, who are the people who are the fighters. If you have the title and you don't have the fight in you, then either you need to partner with people who know how to battle and know how to fight, or just step aside, because this is a real test of this country is whether or not it's going. We're at a crossroad. And so a general strike would be one in which not only are we going to have a message around a general strike, we're going to have a time period of the general strike, but we're also going to be able, like the Montgomery bus boycott did in Montgomery, Alabama, that we're going to say, I'll tell you another one we have. We had an economic strike when we saw dolphins being caught in the tuna fish nets. And people forgot that many people stopped buying tuna because of the killing of those dolphins. So that was a nationwide strike that changed the industry, and they changed the way in which they caught tuna after that. So we've had generalized national strikes before, and we can continue to have national strikes, but we have to have the leadership and the messaging around them.
What do you think of the name, No Kings?
I think that it is a brilliant way in which we are saying our democracy is at risk, and this particular person who is in the White House believes himself to be a king, and his, you know, some people have called them gangsters, others minions, followers, whoever they may be in the Congress and other parts of the country, are using the power of our government in the way of a monarch. So I think No Kings. I also like Fight for Our Rights, because that's the other thing that's going on, the ignoring of the Constitution, even when this six-member majority Supreme Court goes against Donald Trump, to have the administration just ignore the orders of the court, means that our rights are in jeopardy. Our basic human rights and constitutional rights are in jeopardy. So no, we want our rights. No kings fight for our rights. There are many ways in which we can very quickly tell the government what's at stake here. So I do appreciate No Kings. I do think that it is clear, but I also think that there are people, as you pointed out, who may believe they're not shopping at Target because of the stance against pride or the determination not to, to focus on having pride, but also anti-DEI. What happened to diversity, equity, and inclusion? That's, if we don't have enough people at the table in order for us to come together with clear messaging, then, for example, the African-American community is saying, you're having protests. They're not the most effective because we're not a part of them. And we have been a part of protests, especially Black women, for over 200 years. So why are we not figuring into the leadership of these protests so you can better understand how to message, how to be more effective? So I think there's a lot that has to be said about the messaging, but also the people at the table who are developing the messaging.
You know, a lot of people invoke MLK and the ideal of nonviolent protest as an ideal, which ultimately that was, like you say, protest aimed at persuasion. But we saw even during that era, right, as the Vietnam War ramped up, it was supplanted by people who favored a more confrontational style of protest, one that many on the left, I guess, then felt was more authentic to their anger. How do you think about those different approaches and what we're seeing happening today?
Protest has always been confrontational. Always throughout the history of protest. And that's what the nonviolent protest then brought that was unique, that it was nonviolent when protest was usually confrontational and often violent. And the violence was usually against the protester. And so when we think about something as simple as the 8-hour workday, for those people around economic protests, the 8-hour workday was signed into law in the 1800s. It didn't become a reality until the 1900s. Why? Because of protest. So people can have rights that are on the books. The Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791. It gave us the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. No one gets to that last line of the First Amendment. We have the right under the Constitution to petition the government for a redress of grievance. To petition is to ask. For a redress is a remedy, a grievance is a complaint. We have the right to complain to our government about what it is we feel they need to change. Usually, when people stand up for those rights, they are oppressed and they are, the victims are objects of violence. To have a nonviolent protest meant that when violence was used against them, the protester, they did not react with violence. So we've confused what a nonviolent protest means in the first place.
You're listening to a mid-October conversation from The 21st Show. Host Brian Mackey is talking with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, who wrote the new book, A Protest History of the United States. She's also a professor of constitutional law in New York.
A few more text messages. Christopher in Brimfield said, I attended the rally in Peoria. It was amazing and very peaceful. The GOP was trying to spin the event as the Hate America protest. They couldn't have been more wrong. Cassidy in Urbana said, I went to the rally in Urbana. It was peaceful, beautiful, moving, and empowering. I hope that this empowers our legislators to fight for the rights of all Americans and not allow this mockery of democracy to continue. All right, there was a book a few years ago by Eitan Hersh called Politics is for Power. And he basically argues that too many people, liberals, progressives especially, have become political hobbyists, right? People who obsessively follow the news and think that counts as being politically active. What do you think of that? Do you see that changing now under the current climate?
I like that phrase, the mockery of democracy, because I think the mockery is that our democracy is being used against us. All the different elements that we took for granted, that we studied in a certain generation in school, you know, are now being seen as fault lines and vulnerabilities that can be used against the people who believed in them. So those people who have been following politics, who are trying to understand, are of a certain generation. We have young people who don't have civics in their schools in K through 12. It was deliberately taken out to dumb down the generation of people and make them more dependent upon, you know, I guess the big brother or big daddy in office. Don't worry, I'll take care of it for you. So people are trying to figure out what their government is doing. They're trying to figure out how they can be a part of it. And just to let you know, even though I wrote this book, A Protest History of the United States, that's out now, I have an animated series called Your Democracy that was published by an NPR affiliate, WHYY in Philadelphia. Your Democracy, that's animated, that young people can look at, that teachers can share in their classrooms, that people can get a refresher course on our democracy. And I think that's what's so important here. We're still trying to figure it out. We're sincerely trying to have a role in our government the way we were taught we were supposed to. So yes, we could be armchair politicians, you know, or Tuesday morning, not even Monday morning anymore, quarterbacks. But it's all out of sincerity of trying to understand what our government is doing. And at the core of it is this: community is where we have to go. This is a diverse nation. And there are people in positions who want to go back to the 1950s when it was thought that there was only a white male leadership. And that was the white male with money in business. Those people are only supposed to be the leaders and everybody else is supposed to be a follower. In the 21st century, we are embracing community. And that's why so many people are saying the beauty of community and diversity in the protests. And it needs to be even more community, because as we go to the year 2045, this country is going to be even more diverse. And that's what's fear, the fear factor of these people who are trying to take us back to the 1940s and 1950s. They want it to be one in which is controlled by wealthy white men. And unfortunately, they can stall this, and that's what they're doing, but they can't stop community. And as long as we're unified around community, if we stay unified around our message, the power of the people will go forward. And the protests have to get bigger. They have to be persuasive. The messaging has to be clearer that we are about community and diversity, and that's where the nation needs to go.
We had a conversation on the program a few months ago about Black activists, some number of them saying they were taking a step back from protesting in 2025 and, you know, in the name of safety, maintaining their sanity, however you want to say it. I wonder what you think of that, and if that's something you see out there.
I've seen it. I've talked to different people. I've been traveling around on this book tour around the country. I was just in Nashville and Memphis this past week, and Little Rock, Arkansas, as I said, protesting the No Kings protest in Little Rock, Arkansas. That was peaceful, that was diverse, but it was majority white, and I didn't see a lot of people of color there. And I think there was a disheartening of the fact that people would vote for somebody who said initially that he was going to do many of the things he's already said that he is going to do, he did. And especially for Latinos to vote for him, for men, and even not as many Black men, but, you know, certain Black men, to have women support this particular candidacy, to go into what was seen as anti-woman type rhetoric. I think it's really disconcerting for Black women in particular, because Black women have been at the forefront of protests for over 200 years. Before we even gained the right to vote, we had political organizations and grassroots organizations and social groups that were part of protesting for women's rights. Even when white women turned their backs on us, Black women did all of these things that were necessary to lay the foundation for what we have today. And for all the work to go into that and have it dismantled, you know, it did, you know, set a lot of Black women back as far as their enthusiasm for protest. And why should we now protest for people who voted for this regime? That's a mindset, and it's clear, but I do understand it. I believe that, and I continue to do this work because Breonna Taylor was at rest. She was in her home when she was gunned down. And I do not believe that sitting out is the answer, because yes, rest can be resistance, but how long are we going to rest? We're going to have to go back into this, because this leadership needs us. Of the protests I'm seeing, they need us. And when I've spoken to groups around the country, and they've said that You know, Black women have not been in a leadership position, even in New York City. I had a chance to talk with people there, and they did not have Black women in a leadership and weren't reaching out because they believe they can do this without us. I don't think they can, not effectively. The Black women and the fact that we have been in this for so long, we bring an institutional knowledge to this. We bring an insight and a creativity, not just creative signs, but actually having the creativity and strategy and tactics needed for effective protest. An effective protest in many different areas, not just in the street. You're going to have to tap into the knowledge of Black women, and that has to happen sooner rather than later. We're going to have to come together on this. Black women, I want us to realize, yes, we've been hurt, and we are disgusted with what has happened, but it is something that we have to bring to the table because it's going to roll. This ball of oppression, as I said to about the farmers, is going to roll up to us, as we've seen with the Black women who are losing their positions in government that they deserve, that they are being laid off, that they are not receiving the positions they should have in corporate America as well as in the government. So I think it's important that Black women, Black people generally, Black and young people actually, because the young people were angry too. Why would these people vote for this man? And young people are looking at the elders and looking at the other generations with disgust. What do you want from us? Why would you do this to your own country? What did you expect? You expected to hurt other people, but it wouldn't hurt us and hurt yourself. So there are a lot of questions that we need to be in a room to talk about on the left, to the progressive side. There are some conversations that need to happen. But I also believe that we have to have the Black woman in this fight in order to be as effective as we can possibly be effective, because the regime we're fighting against, it needs all hands on deck from the side of the progressives. And that means Black women at the table.
Let me just remind listeners, we're talking with Gloria Brown Marshall. Her book is A Protest History of the United States. Your book is part of a series from Beacon Press. It's called Revisioning History, or maybe Revisioning History, if you want to emphasize it that way. I wonder what that means to you.
That means that something that's going on just this moment, the banishing of books, because this regime, and I call it a regime because he called himself a dictator, and dictators have regimes. The banning of history, for people to not allow young folks and others to actually read what this country has done in the past. It wants to have this Santa Claus viewpoint of America. And you take your country, and I do, warts and all. I'm an American. I'm an African American. I'm a woman. I've been able to have a life in this country, navigating lots of obstacles of racism, sexism, and all other types of discrimination. But it is my country of birth. And my book, A Protest History of the United States, has with it in a through line my great-great-grandmother Eliza, who was born enslaved in Kentucky in this country and traveled as an exoduster. So I'm a proud exoduster, that group in the 1870s who traveled from the South to the North, and she then started again in Kansas. All of that is American history. And these people here are trying to ban over 24,000 titles banned in this country because they don't want to hear about American history. All of this is history. And if you learn from your history, you can go forward. But to ban it, I think, is part of this changing of what we want to think of as America. And America's old enough. It's a young country compared to the old world of England and France, but it's old enough now, mature enough to deal with its history. And if we don't deal with the history, we're going to continue to have time periods like this when people want to have this fable as America. Next year is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, a protest document. And we need to understand that we're old enough to deal with the good, the bad, and ugly of being American. And being American means all of these things are part of our history, our present, and will be part of our future. And trying to deny it is not going to make it go away.
Yeah, people may think they're done with history, but history may not be done with us. Is there ever a point where there's no longer a need for protest?
No. That's just like protest is part of what human beings do when they feel they're not treated fairly. It's we can call it by the name of protest, but if you go back biblically, you can go back as far as you want. Go back to, you know, the Jews leaving Israel. leaving Egypt, I should say. Israelites leaving Egypt. People have protested in many, many different ways. They're always going to stand up when they feel they're being oppressed. That's human nature. And so for us to protest in our country is to be American, is to protest. That's how America began, through protest, and we'll continue to protest. The status quo gets to a certain place, they are comfortable, and they want everybody else to be comfortable. And other people are going to say, no, that's not my comfort level. I want something more, something different, and I'm going to stand up for that right. And when I think about my ancestors in protest history of the United States, I follow my ancestors. This is an interdisciplinary book that has history, it has law, it has interviews with people who have protested, but it also has this idea that we're going to protest in different ways. Survival is protest. When we re-envision history, it's incorporating what has been told as this idea that Santa Claus gave us our rights today. We wake up every day, Brian, with this idea of what we've gained from protest, the benefit from it. And so we need to not be freedom freeloaders, where we are resting on the laurels of people who protested in the past. We need to know that we have an investment to make for the future of this country, and that investment involves protest.
That was Gloria J. Brown Marshall. She's a civil rights attorney who's litigated cases for the Southern Poverty Law Center and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She spoke with my colleague, Brian Mackey, the host of the 21st Show in mid-October. That's all for this week's show. Next week, we're talking about holiday foods. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are part of Illinois Public Media, a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We'll talk with you next week.